Six Music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
Ride it all out like a bird in the sky woods. Ride it all out like you were a bird. Fly it all out like an eagle in a sunbeam. Ride it all out like you were a bird. In the old days, wear a tall hat and a tattooed gown. Ride a white swan that the people of a bell dream. Wear your hair long, babe, you can't go wrong. Catch a bright star and a place it on your forehead. Say a few spells and baby, there you go. Take a black cat and sit you down your shoulder. And in the morning you'll know all you know.
Welcome to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, on Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shape their lives and their careers. And on today's show, the last in this series of The First Time, I speak to someone who may not be a musician, but has spent a life shaping one of the biggest and one of the greatest music festivals in the world, Emily Evis. Emily's father, Michael, staged the first Glastonbury Festival at Worthy Farm in Somerset in 1970, and the first headliner was the band you just heard, T-Rex, and that was their first hit from 1970, Ride a White Swan. Emily was born in 1979 and, as you would expect, grew up surrounded by music. The festival took place on her family's farm, and the event has always been a deeply personal event for the whole Evis family. And in 1999, she took up a role alongside Michael in organising the festival. Here she talks about her earliest Glastonbury memories, how she came to get involved in the event after the death of her mother, and some of the legends that have graced the stage. She also talks about how the festival nearly folded in the lead-up to Jay-Z's performance in 2008, and how this year's lineup has been put together, and who's on the hit list for the future. And I start by asking Emily, as I do with all my guests on The First Time, when was she first aware of music?
Probably from quite a young age, actually, because we had this festival going, and so we were listening to a lot of music, and during the milking, the radio would always be on quite loudly, so if you were in the garden, you could kind of hear this music blasting out, and that's often how my dad would discover bands. He'd listen to the radio whilst milking. And I remember him hearing Primal Scream for the first time because he jumped on the back of a cow to turn the volume up on the radio because it was really high up. It was kind of like on a ledge at the top and he had to sort of like jump up. We used to listen to a lot of music. We listened to a lot of Bob Dylan. He was the sort of main soundtrack to everything, really, from Street Legal, which was my parents' sort of favourite record, to kind of everything that he released, really, after that. We were just continually listening to... We went through the whole 80s phase as well. Like, we just embraced it all.
What's the Bob Dylan track we should play, then?
Probably Where Are You Tonight, I reckon. Just because it kind of... It's hard to choose one because they all mean a lot to me. But I think Where Are You Tonight has a sort of energy to it, which is sort of kind of desperate. It's brilliant. There's a long distance train rolling through the rain. Tears on the letter I write.
woman I long to touch, and I'm missing her so much. But she's drifting like a satellite. There's a neon light ablaze in a green smoky haze, and laughter down on Elizabeth Street. There's a lonesome bell torn in that valley of stone, where she bathed in a stream of pure heat. A bit more than streetwise, but he practiced what he preached from the heart. A full-blooded Cherokee, he predicted it to me, the time and the place that we part. There's a babe in the arms of a woman in a rage, and a long-time golden hand stripper on stage, and she winds back the clock, and she turns back the page of a book that nobody can write. Oh, where are you tonight? The truth was obscure, too profound and too pure.
Paris.
What about the first single you owned, though? The first single that was yours?
Oh, the first thing that I actually bought?
Mm.
The first thing I bought was...
And be honest as well, don't say it was something cool.
No, I know, definitely wasn't. No, I wasn't at all informed by anything that was cool. I'm not saying this wasn't cool, actually. This kid, you might think this is really cool. I think it's pretty cool. Hot House Flowers.
Okay.
That was the first record I bought.
What was it?
I'd seen them play here. I must have been about 11, I think. Maybe 10. I don't know. Young. But I just sort of saw them play, and it was a really sunny day. And it was like everyone was kind of dancing in the crowd. And I just remember thinking, this is really good. I think it was Don't Go. That one.
I quite like that song. Don't Go?
Yes, but it's really good, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, I just look back on it and go, that's good. It's a good summery festival song. And I was always guided by what I saw here. I never was guided by, you know, smash hits or anything, if you know what I mean. Because I wasn't exposed to sort of the other side of the music industry, really. I was just watching the bands here. And so I kind of was like, oh, I like that. I'm going to go and get that.
Sandy beaches and my toes are submerged in the water and it feels good. The children playing, building castles on the shoreline like a painting that we loved and loved. It feels so fine. Don't go, don't lay down now. While the sun smiles, stick around, laugh a while, yeah. Stick around.
Who were your first sort of musical obsessions? Did you have posters on your wall of bands and stuff like that?
Yeah, I didn't really go through the sort of boy band phase. I don't know why. I remember everyone at school being really into like Brass and stuff. I don't know. I think I just was in a slightly different, like in just a zone where I don't know why I wasn't into that. I'm not saying it wasn't at all like for any sort of reason that it wasn't that I thought it wasn't cool or anything. I just was like, I was listening to quite different music here, I think. And like just being in a slightly
different
festival
place.
Bubble, you know, where you kind of, we'd go to gigs on school nights and like just see all these new bands. And I was into Lenny Kravitz.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was kind of, you know, however you want to call it, like a, not a teenage, but probably about 13.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, this is exciting.
I normally ask people about their first gig, but I guess that's kind of irrelevant because you kind of grew up around gigs though, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Can you remember the first person you saw on stage though? Or was it just too many to choose from?
I remember the sort of hysteria of the Smiths because I was probably about 5 or 6 maybe. And I remember, and I, you know, people talking about it for a long time afterwards and sort of, because it was such a big moment for the festival and like it had sort of crossed from being sort of hippie bands, you know, Hawkwind and all of our sort of, you know, the early sort of festival bands to being a sort of pop group. And there was a lot of like people were quite kind of, it divided people a bit when Smith spoke, because it was like, oh no, it's going really sort of trendy now. This is, you know, bad news, it's sold out. There's a story about the stage crew misspelling the name on the list on the side of the stage with the running time, with the time, stage times. And it just says this. It just said the Smits. And they'd taken out the H. It's a real sort of diss because they're all like, should be Auckland. Yeah, I remember all that, but I really remember Elvis Costello and Van Morrison, and those sort of there were a few acts that played a lot in the 80s. Billy Bragg, you know, I remember a lot of those moments, you know, which happened.
Did you meet a lot of these people when you were very young? You must have had some kind of contact with them, because most kids growing up don't really get to hang out with musicians. You must have been like, oh, so Elvis Costello, how you doing?
No, not really. We've always sort of veered slightly away from the backstage areas. I think it's something to do with it being slightly awkward, that whole environment. You know, it's just like, it's much better just to stay out front, I think. But my dad used to always pick up Van Morrison from the train station. I think that was part of the deal. So we'd often all just traipse along to Castle Carey and pick him up. And then all the way back, we'd be like talking about, you know, what he was going to play and which songs and stuff. And there was always, it always sort of depend. It was a bit, you know, dependent on what the mood he was in and what we'd suggest. But yeah, so there were things like that. But you know, it was just so small at that point that it wasn't like big stars coming to the festival. Do you know what I mean?
Which Van Morrison track should we play?
Oh yeah, that's a good one. What about Don't Look Back?
Stop dreaming. never gonna look back.
Okay, who was the first band that you booked then? Can you remember the first time you picked up the phone for the first band and went that you were responsible for and said, I want them?
I know, it's hard because in the 90s, I suppose as I got more and more sort of into music, and we'd always have like debates around the dinner table and stuff, and there was always like, you know, who it should be, who it shouldn't be, you can't have them. So I can't, probably like my year was probably 1995 when I sort of just came into my musical. That was my, I was just turning 15.
That was a good year.
And there was all those sort of Britpop bands that I was really into, you know, and there was just so many. And 94, we'd had Radiohead. We also had Blur in 94. And we had quite a lot of those bands that were on much lower slots. And then I think in 95, everything sort of shot through. And we had all these really, you know, these bands that were just like Oasis and Pulp. And
that was the year that I played, so thank you for that.
Yeah, I was just about to say that. Hang on a minute.
Thank you.
That was. And the Verve were playing, weren't they? Were you on the other stage?
We were on the other stage, yeah.
Yeah. And the Verve played on the other stage in the afternoon, didn't they, on Saturday?
And the one that everyone talks about was Pulp.
And Pulp's
headline set, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they stood in for the Stone Roses. That year, there was just a lot of... It was really hot year. And everyone... I don't know, I just finished my GCSE, so I was just on a real high. I know, it felt like real... I just felt, yeah, totally into it. And anyway, there were lots of brilliant bands on that year, and I just watched bands all weekend. And that was probably the year that I'd done quite a lot of the bookings. I wouldn't like to say that it was just one, but it could have been, you know, Pulp could have easily have been one of the ones that I suggested having when the Stone Roses blew up.
She came from Greece, she had her first for knowledge. She studied sculpture at St. Martin's College. That's where I told me that a dad was London. I said that case was rubber. Coca-Cola, she said fine. And then in 30 seconds time, she said, I wanna live like common people. I wanna do whatever common people do. Wanna sleep with common people. I wanna sleep with common people like you. Well, what else could I do? I said, I'll see what I can do. I took it to a supermarket. I don't know why, but I had to start it somewhere. So it started there. I said, pretend you got no money. And she just laughed and said, you're so funny. I said, yeah. Well, I can't see anyone else smiling at you. Are you sure? You wanna live like common people. You wanna see whatever common people see. Wanna sleep with common people. You wanna sleep with common people like me. But she didn't understand. And she just smiled and held my hand. And just above the shop, and cut your hair and get a job. Smoke some fags and play some pool. Pretend you never went to school. Still you never forget it right. Cause when you're ready to bed at night, watch your ghosts climb the wall. If you called your dad, he could stop it. You never do whatever comes.
you, I never warned you, look out. They'll tear your insides out. Cause everybody hates a tourist, especially when it thinks it's all such a laugh. And the chest and the grease that come out in the bath, you will never understand how it feels to live your life with no meaning or control and with nowhere left to go. You are a race and they exist and they burn so bright whilst you can.
That is, of course, Pulp with Common People, live at Glastonbury, taken from their headlining set in 1995, a high point for the band and the festival's career. I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, and my guest this week is Glastonbury organiser Emily Evis.
This is
Six Music.
Six Music.
Six Music.
Thank you.
That's a beautiful performance of One Day Like This by Elbow, taken from their performance at the Glastonbury Festival in 2011. I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, where we look at the first key musical moments in someone's career. And my guest this week is Glastonbury organiser Emily Evis. Did you try and escape the kind of festival route when you were younger? Because your first career wasn't going to be running festivals, was it?
You know. No, not at all. God, no. It was the last thing I thought I'd be doing, to be honest.
Did you want to escape from it a little bit when you were a teenager, do you think?
Yeah, well, when I was a teenager, I got a bit more into it. I got really into it, actually, because when I started camping out on the festival site and with my mates and checking these bands out and stuff, I loved all that. But when I was little, like really little, I found it a bit scary just because it was a bit more unpredictable then. So you had a lot more, there was a lot more grief, you know. There was always some sort of major drama, like every 5 minutes. Like when I did my violin thing, which I played 1 year, which was, well, it was probably 1980. That was before the Style Council in 1985, I think.
You got on stage and played violin.
So I ended up playing violin, which I know everyone's heard that thing. But the reason that my dad didn't make it is because he was sectioning a man up a telegraph pole, because there was a man who was stuck up a telegraph pole. And there were all these sorts of things that happened all the time. You know, just these kind of quite major crises. Mm. He'd be like, oh, there's a man up a telegraph pole, you know, quit everyone. And there wasn't like a sort of support network in the way there is now, you know. It wasn't, there was lots of offices because everything went through the house. We had a phone, one phone, and everything came through here. Do you know what I mean? So all of the meetings and everything was here. So it was quite hectic at times.
So what did you want to do instead? Is it right that you wanted to be a teacher?
Yeah.
What changed your mind then? Was there a moment when you were like, actually, this is where I belong?
I think I only recently thought that. I was training to be a teacher, and when after my mom died, I came back and sort of life just, I ended up being here because I was sort of, you know, with my dad and trying to help get through really the sort of the first couple of years, which were quite hard, really hard. And I think it was sort of the natural place for me to be was to be here, where we could both sort of throw all of our energy into the festival, because the festival was so much about their relationship, and they threw everything into this festival, and you know, and my whole life, everything has just been completely absorbed by it. You know, we just loved it, and it caused a lot of grief as well, but it was always a bit of a battle with the council, and everyone was always being prosecuted, and there were always all these battles, but every year, you know, pretty much it would come back, and it just felt so much a sort of part of their relationship and the love affair that they kind of had, that I just felt really like I had to be here.
That first festival without your mum must have been really difficult.
Yeah. 99, it was really hard. It was a bit of a daze, to be honest, because she died about a month before the festival. And so the site was already being built and everything was sort of carrying on. And we were like in complete shock and sort of in that immediate sort of grief period. So it was a really amazing festival. There was a silence across the site. I was late, because we were going to go down to do this little presentation on the stage, and I was running down from the house, and I didn't realise that the silence had already started, and the whole campsite, people were just stood outside of their tents, just totally silent, and I was completely like floored by it. I just was like, this is amazing. I felt really supported by it. It was amazing. It was like, wow, people are really connecting with what we've been going through, and you know, like, just understand the importance of what's happened, and it was really lovely. So we went down, and then REM played that night, and they played a song for my mum, which was really sweet.
Which song was it?
The one I love. And there were tributes all over the site, and so in a way it was a really special year, because it kind of marked everything that was important to us, and it was just lovely that people kind of understood and marked and did their own little tributes, and yeah, but it was a difficult year as well. You look back and go, how did we get through that? but we did.
This one goes out to This one goes out to the one I've left behind. A simple prop to occupy my time. This one goes out to
Can you remember the very first song of Jay-Z's set and the kind of... Because I remember the issues around the festival at that time. And not only the controversy about Jay-Z, which has been covered loads, but more the kind of the previous year. And I don't think people realised quite how tough it got. And you were kind of saying, look, you know, we nearly didn't have a festival.
Yeah.
It did get that bad, didn't it? So seeing Jay-Z must have been kind of like... We've done it. We're okay. It's working.
It's funny. A lot of people put it down to Jay-Z or, you know, talk about him being responsible. But actually, it was really nothing to do with him. The problem was that the year before had been really difficult. Mm. It was really wet and there were sound problems on the pyramid and half the crowd couldn't hear the Killers. And then obviously what happens is people were like, actually, I don't really want to go. You know, I need a break, which is fair enough. People do need a break because you can't go every year necessarily. It's quite a lot to ask. Then the tickets didn't resell. We did sell like 80,000 on the first day.
Which isn't bad.
Which was pretty good, but it was deemed as like an absolute disaster by the press. And so suddenly it was like, okay, because this is all adding on to just the fact that it's all been really difficult and it's a difficult year. So then we announced that Jay-Z was playing. And I think on the back of all of the trouble, it was just like, they've gone mad. You know, this is, they've actually, you know, lost it. It was bad anyway, but now this is like, you know. So that's what happened. And I actually started to get nervous and we were all scared in the run up because everything, once there's that momentum, it's really hard to get anything positive out there. Mm-hmm. You could literally be like, you know, we are doing this or we're doing that or we're, you know, you could come out with the best plan for the festival and say, we're doing this amazing project, but no one's interested because once you're on a negative tip, it's just rolling. Mm-hmm. And so we just thought, okay, well, there's not really a lot we can do here. And the tickets weren't selling and we were getting really, really scared and we thought it was, you know, we were like, actually, even having conversations like, well, it's, you know, we've done pretty well to get this far. And, you know, it's not going to last forever. We always knew it wasn't going to last forever. And so all these sort of conversations were going. And Michael was having sleepless nights and I was having anxiety dreams. And oh, it was really stressful. Anyway, when Jay-Z took to the stage, it was just like within about 5 seconds, you knew that he was just going to, he'd turned it around. And it was so much pressure on that gig and the atmosphere was so jittery and I just can't tell you how nervous I was before it happened. And we were watching on the side of the stage and my dad just looked at me. He was just like laughing. I remember looking at him. He was laughing, going, look at this. It was so, it was amazing, that moment, because it really felt like, you know, we can do it. You know, you just got to trust your instincts and go with what you think is going to work.
When did you first approach the Stones then? When did the Stones process start? When was the first phone call made? How many years ago?
I think there have been conversations for, you know, forever, since the beginning, probably.
As long as that?
Well, I think probably the last 20 years at least, anyway. I mean, a long time. The actual serious conversations have been taking place since the end of the last festival, really. I think people have sort of envisaged this, like, real struggle or, you know, fight or problems with money or whatever, which just hasn't been at all the case. You know, they're really up for it and sort of know that, you know, what it's about and understand that everyone gets the same. And, you know, and we only got confirmation from it about 24 hours before we announced it.
Because this is the thing, I think the image is that because bands don't get paid a lot to do Glastonbury, which is one of the great things about it, is that I think it seems to be maybe until Bruce Springsteen did it that maybe some of the bigger American acts were kind of a little bit, well, why should we do it? We're going to lose money on this. And I think Springsteen doing it was kind of like, look, this is about the event.
Completely, yeah. It was Jay-Z was led to Springsteen, which led to all of the other American acts. That's basically how it worked.
As the Stones song filming thing been sorted out yet, do you know?
Yeah, it has been. I think this whole story about them not agreeing to film much or just that it's all in, it's all good, it's all healthy conversations going on, but it's not difficult.
Yeah.
We've had some struggles with people not being filmed, but this isn't actually one. But it's not the whole set.
It's going to be some of the set.
Some of the set.
Somerset.
Some of the set in Somerset.
Who's left on the dream list? I mean, you must get asked this every year, and it's weird to ask it before the festival when you're concentrating on this one, but there must be, you mentioned Adele earlier, there must be like a list sort of on a post-it note in the kitchen somewhere, just like, we'll make those calls.
Yeah, it's on a napkin, actually, on the fridge. We'd love to have Adele. We'd also really love to have Led Zeppelin. Just Led Zeppelin, I've got to do it, surely. Be so good, wouldn't it?
I mean, Robert Plant's got a pretty close connection with the place, isn't he?
Yeah, and so is Jimmy Page. So come on. No, I think, you know, it would be great to have them. And there's a few others that we haven't had. But it's quite important to keep the new bands coming through. I think, you know, that is really an important element of keeping headliners coming through, creating headliners as well. But Mumford, I guess, this year as well, you know, because they have appeared in the last 5 years, really, they've sort of come through. to that level. So, yeah, we've got to keep putting them up there, because otherwise we're going to run out.
What's the last song that we should play? You can pick anything. What should we finish the show on?
Oh, maybe Bowie.
Why and what Bowie are you going to choose?
We love Bowie, obviously.
Oh, who doesn't like Bowie?
Yeah, exactly. And he played in 1971 and he came back in 2000. And he came back with the same jacket that he was wearing in 1971. And he had his hair in the same kind of way, which was sort of long and wavy.
The hair was amazing. I remember the hair was pretty spectacular.
It was. And the detail, you know, to bother sort of, you know, coming on stage in the same attire. It was just brilliant. And he did this incredible set. And it was one of the best things that I've seen here. And he talked a lot from the stage about getting stoned in the farmhouse, which I was a bit like, hang on a minute. It's always been a no drugs policy. Anyway, I think Heroes, just because that is such a sort of festival song, and it was used in the Julian Temple film when he made that about the festival, and it just was brilliant. And he played it, and he talked in the intro about his memories of being here and kind of going on stage at 4 a.m. So I think that, let's play that for the out.
Then we'll play it. Thank you very much, Emily.
Thank you.
This is BBC.
BBC Radio.
Six Music.
you away. Just like watching the detectives. Don't get cute. Just like watching the detectives. 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 Watching the detectives.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music. Right now.
This is the Morning After Mix.
You're about to hear a shortened version of the Morning After Mix, a carefully curated playlist available in the BBC Sounds app. It's full of gentle songs for when you need a musical rescue or escape. To find the full version, just search Morning After in the app. But for now, enjoy the calm.